I want to start out, we hadn't met for a month because of the snow and the snow and the snow. One of the things that I've been doing to start this meeting is to try to answer a couple of questions that have come in from what I've been teaching on Sunday. And every week, it seems like when I teach through the Baptist doctrine and Baptist beliefs, I've been getting questions. And I understand, simply because what I'm trying to do on Sunday morning, I don't have enough time to really give you an overview of what happened in the Reformation and how we got to where we are and why we're there and all those kind of things. And so sometimes that can lead to questions, especially people that didn't grow up in a Baptist faith, or you didn't have training union when you were growing up, or even if you did, some of us don't even remember or understand why we do what we do. And so, yeah, well, some mind-wise. And so I got a bunch of questions in the last couple of weeks, and all of them are good questions, but some of them more relevant than others. So I'm just going to answer three of them. And the reason I'm doing it here, it's easier to talk about it than it is to type out a long response, because people then have more questions and more questions. And we've got about 30 to 40 people that are listening to this study each week. And so hopefully I've been sending people there if they do have questions. So you see the questions listed on there. If you have anything to add to that, and I'm not going to give you a complete answer on these as well, because I could take a whole hour and talk about each one of these three. And so I just kind of want to give you a snapshot to help you understand, and the people that ask the question understand what's going on. The first is the idea of Anabaptist or the Separatist, which where we flow out of. General Baptist and Particular Baptist is the line that we come out of, the Anabaptist. Why were they so adamant to the point of being willing to die against infant baptism? The issue, the question, and I got several of them. If the people that are baptizing the people as infants believe that it's just symbolic and it's not salvific, it's not saving those people, it's just symbolically bringing them into the community of faith, then why were the Credo Baptists, you had the two groups, Credo Baptist and the Paedo Baptist, which means infant baptism, why were they willing to die to say they stood against it so strongly? Why were they willing to say, this is not to be done? Well, it all goes back to what happened at the Reformation. When baptism up until the Reformation was a sacrament. It was done as part of the seven rituals that you go through as a part of the Catholic faith to be able to earn grace and earn your way into favor with God. And so you participated in the sacraments, and baptism was one of the sacraments that you had to do to be a part of the church and to be included in the church. And part of baptism and everything that came out of the Roman Catholic Church was the sacerdotalism, which is a big Latin word which just simply talks about priestly rules. What was big when the Reformation happened, the question they asked was, what role do priests or preachers or ministers play? Because in the Catholic Church, remember, the priests were the go-between God and man, and it was a big deal. And in the Roman Catholic Church, the baptism by a priest was an initiation into the community. And so, and please understand, if you come out of a faith tradition that you baptized as an infant or you were baptized as an infant, there's nothing wrong with that. Matter of fact, some of the leading scholars and theologians, John Stott and Tim Keller, who's a modern theologian today, C.S. Lewis, R.C. Sproul, J.R. Packer, all of those people practice paedobaptism, infant baptism. And the way that they justify it is that they compare it to an Old Testament covenant of circumcision. And the reason infant baptism even became an issue in the Reformation, instead of saying, no, we're going to start baptizing like they did, they had to answer the question, what do you do with a baby or an infant or a child that dies before they make a confession of faith? Because in the old idea, they had already gone through the sacrament of baptism in the Catholic Church, so there was a comfort knowing that they were a part of the church. But now, on this side of the Reformation, all of a sudden you begin to say, no, that you're not saved by works, you're saved by faith. Well, what happens? You know, the mortality rate of infants was around 80% in the 1500s. They would have, you know, 8, 9, 10 kids and 3 may live. Or, you know, 15 kids and 8 or 9 may live. And so every family was facing having your child die. What were the ministers going to say If your child wasn't baptized, if they weren't, you're coming out of a Catholic tradition to where your children had been baptized and there was a comfort there, what were you going to tell the parent? And so that is where the idea of continuing the baptism for infants came out of. That is to answer that question, what are we going to do with it? And so what they reasoned, people like Calvin, and which is where it came from, the Presbyterian Church, and Luther did the same thing in the Lutheran Church. Methodists kind of did both when Wesleyanism spread out. But what they decided was, is they were going to look at the Old Testament covenant of circumcision. Circumcision didn't make you a part of the covenant. It was a sealing, a sign that you were a part of the covenant. And so they compared baptism to circumcision in the New Testament, to say that you were baptized not as a being saved, but to baptize you into the body, the community of faith. They would argue that children of Christian parents had a little better track record or chance, or they were in a different standard than children of non-Christian parents. And so that was, you know, so that there was already a community of faith, and you're recognizing your child as a part of that community of faith, and somehow that would bring comfort to a parent whose child died, that they were part of this community of faith. And it began to continue to develop until even in some Presbyterian churches where it got to be the idea of grace, that in a strong Reformed church that teaches predestination, Calvinism, the idea is that you are confirming that they are part of the elect in the baptism, that they are part of the church body already, and that's going to be confirmed later on, but you were saying it early so that if something happens to them. Baptists not only believe that you should make it afterwards in confession afterwards, see, Methodists do both. You can get baptized as an infant, you can get baptized afterwards. So why didn't Baptists say, well, that was okay? Well, it all goes back to Baptist stand on religious freedom. If you remember what we talked about when I talked about soul liberty, is Baptists firmly and strongly believe that every person should be given an opportunity to decide how, when, where, and what they want to worship without coercion, without being persuaded, without being forced. And Baptists felt that by baptizing an infant into a particular faith, you were taking away the choice of that infant on how they would worship, when they would worship, and what they would worship. And so Baptists, standing on the ground of saying that goes against our religious freedom and our soul liberty, we don't think you should be able to do that. Now, that doesn't mean in the church when we dedicate that we're going to influence children in our church and teach children in our church and lead children in our church, but we are not making them a part. They don't become a member of the church when we dedicate them. In the Presbyterian Church, in the Methodist Church, in the Episcopal Church, you become a member of the church when you are baptized. And so you're part of the church body. And so that's why Baptists stood so strong on it. Today, if you ask people, most people don't even know. They don't understand why it's important or what it's important for or why we even do it. And so, but that's a good question, and I appreciate where that comes from. You know, even those that baptize an infant don't think it's salvific. They're not making them saved. It's the difference between an ordinance and a sacrament. And we believe it's an ordinance, not a sacrament. It's not something that makes you saved. It's something that is a proclamation of your salvation. That was so strongly felt in the early Baptists that they were willing to die for it. They were willing to say that we will not baptize our infants because we believe it goes against everything we stand for in soul liberty. Now, we don't mind people that have been baptized as infants in our church, or people that have been baptized when they were younger. We leave that up to the Holy Spirit. Just as if you came and got saved and you walked down an aisle and you were 45, we don't take you from the floor or from when you pray up to the baptistry and run you through it. That's up to you when the Holy Spirit leads you. We encourage you, follow through with that decision. Now, the Church of Christ would say if you don't follow through, then you're not saved, because they believe that baptism is a part of the process to being saved, using the last part of Mark where it says that if you confess and are baptized, and so they put that as one, you know, linkage that you have to be baptized. So they would say that if you confess Christ and don't get baptized, then you're still not a believer. We don't believe that. And so just like we don't make everybody that makes a profession of faith go get baptized, we don't make people who are baptized as infants. We just encourage you to listen to the Holy Spirit. Any questions about that? Second question, which was even better. I talked about religious liberty and religious freedom in America. and how Baptists were instrumental in us having religious freedom in America and us standing up for the freedom of religion, because Baptists came out of being persecuted for 200 years after the Reformation by all of the Reformed movements that mirrored the states that they were a part of. And so you know, if you went against the church, you went against the state, and you could be punished and have your citizenship taken away, and you couldn't be married, and you couldn't have a job, and all the things that happened in Rome when the Catholic Church became part of the official faith in Rome, that was happening again. And so Baptists came to America, and they began to fight for the idea of religious freedom. And so I told you in my sermon that we have got to be adamant and fight every chance we get to make sure that there is always religious freedom in America, that everyone in America has the freedom to choose where they want to worship, how they want to worship, when they want to worship, or if they want to worship. And that means that if a group of Muslims wanted to buy the property across the street and put a mosque up, and the people in the town rose up and said, "We don't want a mosque in Blowing Rock," the Baptist should be the one standing on the side of the Muslim saying, if we can sell it to a restaurant, if we can sell it, then they have a right. They have the same right that if we can buy the property, they should be able to buy the property. If we can buy the property and put a church building, then they should be able to buy property and put a mosque. Now, the question came to me is, do you not cross the line of justifying faiths or religions that you disagree with? Doesn't it sound like by you saying, we believe that they have every right, that just like every other organization, to be able to worship how and when and where, that we're somehow saying that that faith is okay, even though we disagree with them? It's not what we're doing. We're not fighting for what they believe. We're fighting for them to believe what they believe. We're fighting for them to have the ability to believe. And the reason that's so important, and we need, you know, when people ask, because we have grown so comfortable in the United States of America for the last 250 years that Christianity has been the majority faith, whether it's Catholicism or Protestantism, but Judeo-Christian values have reigned. There may come a day when Christianity is not the majority in the United States of America. And by the same token, we treated other minority faiths, we should expect to be treated if we become a minority faith. And so it's easy for us in the South to say, I wish, you know, they couldn't build any of those others because they're crazy and they're whacked out. And I don't like the commune that's up on the mountain. But if you sell that property to anybody else, then they have a right to buy that property. And I will stand for that because I don't want there to ever come a day when you say, we're going to tell you what you can say and how you can say it. Because we believe in freedom as long as it doesn't hinder or infringe on someone else's freedom to worship. And so as long as it's not hindering or infringing on my worship, then you have the freedom to do whatever you want. Because I believe that the Bible will stand up to anything else. As long as it's given free access to stand next to any belief system, I'm not worried about it. I'm not worried that I've got to shut people up so that people can only hear about Jesus. I believe in the power of the cross and the power of the Holy Spirit to overwhelm every other faith. And so I don't want you to confuse that. It doesn't mean, you know, I don't think things are crazier. There are people that have nutty belief systems. I do. I'm not saying their beliefs are right. I'm just saying that they have the right to believe it. And just like I have the right to believe. Did that explain it? Good. And the last one was just on communion. Someone had asked how we got to the place where we do communion the way we do communion. What's the difference between communion and Lord's Supper? What's the difference between communion and Eucharist? There is no difference between communion and Lord's Supper. Same word. Baptists just have traditionally used Lord's Supper instead of communion. I like communion because it expresses the idea of the unity that you experience when you take communion, when you take this part of the Lord's Supper. There is a communion in the community. So that's why I use communion. Eucharist is a totally different inclination. It has a totally different meaning because it came out of the Roman Catholic tradition of what happens to the elements when it's prayed for. And as I mentioned earlier, for centuries, the Roman Catholic Church had taught that just like baptism was a sacrament, communion was a sacrament. Instead of an ordinance, it was a sacrament, which means you had to do it. It could be withheld from you. If you were in sin and you didn't come to confession, the priest had a right to withhold communion from you. If you were divorced, Priests, right, even now, they're still arguing over it. If you are divorced and get remarried in the Catholic Church, a priest can withhold communion from you. That is not just withholding the Lord's Supper, that is withholding to them an act of grace, an experience of grace renewed in their heart every time, because they believe in a theory that was called transubstantiation. And that's a long Latin phrasing to mean that when the priest stands up in front of the body and he blesses the elements, the cup and the bread, that it metaphysically changes into the actual blood and body of Jesus Christ. That Christ's presence is in the elements. That it is the actual body and blood of Christ. And that's why, I went back to that term sacerdotalism, that's why they believe only the priest can do it. And so the Catholics, you had to have the sacrament. They only took the bread, they don't drink the cup, because they believe all of Christ is in both elements. So you don't need to have both, because all of his presence is there. And it is, actually in their theology, it is Christ personally sacrificing himself every time. Every time that they pray over it and it turns to his blood and his body, he offers himself again as a grace sacrifice for them. So it is a continually, the idea that it is finished, that I'll preach on Sunday morning, is foreign to their ideas, because they believe that it is a continued sacrifice, that grace is continuing through that experience. And so the reformers came along and said, what are we going to do with communion? You know, Martin Luther, he liked some of the priestly roles, even though Martin Luther still wanted there to be this pull down between a priest and the layman. Martin Luther actually liked the idea. He believed priests were called out and set apart. And so he continued with what he called the Eucharist. And he said, it does not metaphysically change when the priest prays for it, but there is a metaphorical change. And that's called con-transubstantiation, which is a crazy big word, which just means that while it may not turn into it, Christ, it's not literally his blood and body, but Christ is present spiritually in those elements. And so that when you take that element, you are taking a part of Christ. You are, the idea, they take it literally, Luther took it literally when he said, when you do this, this is my body. Okay, this is Christ's body. I'm taking spiritually Christ's body. And it is a idea of renewal, idea of grace. And so you still see that in the Lutheran church, and you still see that in some of the Anglican churches. Matter of fact, the Anglican church, when it broke off, which is the Episcopal church, they took the Eucharist and made it the most important thing in the service. And so that in an Anglican church, if you go to an Episcopal church, the communion, what we call communion, the Eucharist, is that's the most important thing they do. They read from the Book of Common Prayer, but they also, you know, take from that. And so that was a change. But Calvin wasn't happy with either. John Calvin wasn't happy with Luther's idea, and he certainly wasn't happy with keeping the Roman Catholic. And he said, "It's there's something special to it, but it doesn't change. It's not Christ." And so what he came up with is what's called the spiritual or dynamic theory, which means that it is representative of Christ. There is a spiritual power. And so in Calvin's theology, what he said was that you receive an extra anointing of God's presence when you take the cup and when you take the bread. And so that in those churches that came out of Calvin's dynamic, which is Presbyterianism, they believe that it's like a revival. It's like a renewed grace. There is not a you're not taking the body, you're not taking the blood, it's not in and around it like it was with Luther. But there is something special doing this that signifies something special. Well, Zwingli, who was another reformer, and the Anabaptists, they didn't want to have anything to do with the sacerdotalism, that the priest somehow waves his hand over it and it becomes something special, because they believe that everybody has the same access. But they also believe God's presence, Jesus' presence, is everywhere. You don't need a cup and a bread to experience Jesus' presence. It's in me. It's every time the body gathers, Jesus' presence is there. And you can experience it apart from the cup and the bread. And so they decided it's just symbolic. It is a symbol of us taking in and remembering what Christ went through. And so Baptists have come out. Baptist and Pentecostalism, Church of God, Church of Christ, assemblies, all of those groups that sprung off of Baptists, we all believe it's symbolic. In the Methodist Church today, they would argue that it's symbolic instead of one of these dynamic transfers. And so that's why we do what we do compared to... That's why if you go visit an Episcopal church and they say it's time for communion or time for Eucharist, it's not like the Lord's Supper here. It's not like what we do. It has a deeper significance, and you probably need to pray about whether or not you want to take part in that. Now, some Baptist churches go even further, and they do things like closed communion, where only the local church is allowed to take communion. You know, once Baptists decided this is what we believe, it's symbolic, then we had to fight on something else, and so we started fighting over how often we needed to do it, who got to take it, who got to give it, you know, and so... Every Baptist church is different. There are Baptist churches in this community that when they do communion every week, it's still a weekly, but they dismiss any guests or visitors that are not a member of that church because they believe in closed communion, because they believe it is something for the local body specifically. Some Baptists do it once a month. Some do it once a quarter. You know, and so there's not a hard and fast rule like what's in most other faiths. The Presbyterians will do it almost every week. Anglican will do it every week. Catholics do it every week. Baptist, most of them do it once a quarter, once every 3 months, something like that. And we here have open communion where we believe in the universal body of Christ, that everybody is, all they have to do is be a profession of faith. So, questions about that? And so we can dive into Genesis. And this is just going to be a survey because we're just trying to cover a lot of ground, but I'm going to answer some big questions that you may have. And cover some areas, and I'm trying to do it in a, you know, I tried to put together a consistent timeline, so you'll see a lot of numbers on your outline, because I wanted you to get in your head, if I try to do a timeline and come off of it where all these things are happening, there's too much stuff at different parts, and especially as we get further along the timeline. So I'm trying to create a setting for you where this stuff is happening, and so I want to go back to just make sure you remember, this is nowadays where everything is, but this is the area we're still talking about. Down here, this is Egypt, is over here. This is still part of Egypt today. So that's where everything is happening in a setting that all the stuff is going on. And then, don't pay attention to this stuff because this is still Abram, but I wanted you to see the setting for what it's the same setting that's going on in Genesis 39 through Genesis 50. It's the Middle Bronze Ages. In Egypt, it's the Middle Kingdom time period, but there is a transition taking place. It is the end of the Middle Kingdom, and you begin to see the Hyksos reign. And I talked some about that a month ago. The Hyksos were pharaohs in Egypt who came out of a more agrarian background. They were planters and land people, and so they would... Many people believe that is when the Egyptians prospered in Egypt under the Hyksos reign. And so that's why that's important that it's on there. The dates that I'm giving you are probably the most consensus around. Okay, they're not perfect and I can't prove them to you, but they're the most consensus that people, we can identify when certain pharaohs were there. We can identify when certain things happened. We can go back and identify key points, but the dating... to be able to say this is exactly the year. And so sometimes you'll see 1 year, sometimes 2 years, because different groups argue. But the big numbers are pretty consistent. Joseph lived 110 years. The Bible says that. Moses was 40 when he fled into Midia. He stayed in Midia 40 years. He came back, and then he died 40 years later after the wandering in the wilderness. So he died at 120. We have those numbers that we know that are pretty consistent. And so we can go back from when those things happen and archaeology stuff that we have to paint a picture of what's going on and how it's all happens. And so I just give you some overview of 39 through 50 and what's there. And I'm not going to really go into Joseph's life because I did a whole sermon series on Joseph and we covered it a whole lot in depth. But I want to do just to see where stuff is happening. Remember, they're in this area and Joseph is sold into slavery into Egypt. All of this is Egypt, so we don't know where he was sold into slavery, but he went to Egypt. We believe that Joseph was born in 1914 BC, that he was probably around 20 when he was sold into slavery. That's Genesis 39 through 41. It's probably about 7 or 8, 10 years. There's not a number that we can say he was in prison and he was with Potiphar's wife, but most people say it was probably 10 years or around 10 years to when he rises in leadership. And that happens in 1884 BC. And so it gives you a time period of when things are happening and what's happening. The dynasties you can see are changing as he rises to power. And so the Hyksos come into power as, you know, they're more welcome. They're not in power yet, but they're in the government. And Joseph steps in and becomes a place of leadership in the government. His brothers visit. You know the trick and how he tricked them. Genesis 42 to 45 sends them back. They come back. Jacob decides to come. He reveals himself. And so Jacob comes and moves all of the nation of Israel, all of Abraham's people, all to Egypt. And so we believe that that happened in 1876 BC, which was about 8 years between the time Joseph came in leadership and the time that Jacob moved everybody to Egypt. And that happens in Genesis 46 and Genesis 47. And I put the note on there. It tells you where they moved. It says they moved into the Ramses area in this part of Egypt. The problem with that is there is no, in that kingdom time period, in those dynasties, there was no Ramses. Ramses, the Pharaoh, didn't come till later. And so this is a later name given to where they settled, because this, as Moses or the scribes looking back onto where they settled in this area that is called Quantus, and that is in this area. And there is a town in the area, in the region of Quantus, called today Tel Ed-Debi, which they've done research, and they've gone back and excavated. And they have excavated things that can put Semitic people, Semitic tribes, in that area all the way into 1780 B.C. So in this area, they have evidence of a large gathering. It's kind of like a, I don't want to say a slum area, but a suburb area, a town area that is where the Hebrews lived, the Jewish people lived. And we can go back and document that there was a huge Jewish presence in this area around that time during when they were enslaved. And so the famine takes place, and then you have Jacob blessing Manasseh and Ephraim, who are Joseph's sons. And remember, Manasseh was the oldest, which his name means God caused me to forget or caused to forget. Ephraim, which means twice blessed. There are 12 tribes, and I told you this, you know, a little while ago as we looked at this. Ephraim and Manasseh take Joseph's blessing. Joseph, there is not a tribe of Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh, they become his tribe, but they also take over the tribes of one of the other brothers. And so you begin to see a split that takes place. You add to and you take away to. And so, but what do you remember what happens when he blesses Ephraim and Manasseh? Anybody remember what happens?
The younger son gets the blessing.
He blesses Ephraim instead of Manasseh, which means he you know, and Joseph says, can you not see? And he says, no, I know exactly what I'm doing. And so he gave Ephraim, who was doubly blessed by name, the authoritative blessing over Manasseh. And that, you know, the important part about it, and he's going to bless the rest of his sons here in 49. You can go look it up and read it. These blessings are prophetic. They're not just me saying, live long and prosper, hope you have a good life, hope you marry somebody nice. He speaks prophetically over each one of these tribes. And what we see lived out in those tribes for the next 1,000 years is what he speaks over them. So when you go and read those things, you see that Ephraim becomes much bigger than Manasseh, much more blessed, much more prosperous. And then he goes to his other sons. He calls all the other sons, and he begins to bless them. And he takes away the blessing from Simeon and Levi. And so there is no tribe of Simeon, there is no tribe of Levi. Because, if you remember back, when they first came into Canaan, and they tricked, their sister was in relations with somebody from the king of Shechem's son, and they tricked all of Shechem into getting circumcised. And while they were circumcised, Simeon and Levi went in and killed everybody. And dad didn't forget it. And so he did not bless them with a tribe. And matter of fact, Simeon's tribe would just cease to exist by the time of the Exodus. They just go and live. When the lands are assigned, they go and live with Judah. Levi's tribe becomes the priest tribe, but they never have their own tribe. They live among all the different tribes as part of the priestly rule, especially in the wanderings in the wilderness. So that's significant. And then also he gives Judah, which Judah was not the oldest son. Judah was the fifth son or sixth son. He gives Judah the leadership of the clan, which is significant. If you remember back when we talked about Jacob and Esau, and Jacob getting that birthright and getting that inheritance, he tricked his daddy, because that basically puts him in charge of the whole clan, all the 12 tribes. Well, that goes to the firstborn son, Reuben. Well, Reuben, we didn't even talk about it in here. Reuben ends up sleeping with his dad's mistress, and so he holds that against Reuben. And so he takes the leadership of the whole clan and blesses Judah. And he prophesies there, and I've given you the passages 8 through 12. He prophesies that Judah will be represented by a lion, which is kingly. And he prophesies that he will rule forever. That from the line of the tribe of Judah, there will be a ruler on the earth that will rule the earth forever. The says his reign will never end. And then it talks about his robes being dipped in wine, which is purple, the color of royalty. It's why we do purple as a king and that kind of thing. And so all that's given there at the end of Genesis. Jacob dies and he is embalmed. They take him, which most people don't know and don't read, but you can go read about it in 50 and the end of 49. They load Jacob up. He wants to be buried in Canaan. Wants to be buried in the same place that his forefathers are buried. And so they load up everybody, all the tribes, all the people, representatives, and all their slaves and everything. And they go all the way back up here to Hebron. And they bury Jacob in Hebron. And Joseph tells Pharaoh, I'm leaving to bury my dad. I'm taking all these people, but we're coming back. And so then he comes back, and it tells us that Joseph lives long enough to see his son, grandson, his son's son's son. So he sees three generations that pass down, and he dies. They say he's 110 years old, but we don't know whether for the dating, I'm taking literally. The issue with that is in Egyptian folklore, 110 represented perfect life. The average, if you take the Egyptians that we have from that time period that have been embalmed and we pull them up, the average age is 45. So the average Egyptian lived 45 years. But the Bible says that Joseph died after 110 years, and that puts it at 1804 BC. And so that starts a transition that lasts about 400 years, a little less, a little more, give or take the date that you want to put, where the children of Israel are in Egypt. And it starts out with them being blessed. They are, everything's going great. At the start of Exodus, they are being blessed. They are prosperous. It says they are having more children and growing faster than everybody else. And so during that 400 years, the world changes. Everything starts to change. And we start to begin to see cultures that I put on here that begin to rise. I told you about the Hittites. Last time, the Hittites had wiped out, by this time, during that 400-year period, the Hittites, they owned all of this land. This was all Hittite, but they had also come all the way over here into Asia Minor. So this was all Hittite land, and it was probably one of the greatest kingdoms. And they fought continually with Egypt over transgressions in land. This is desert, not here, but who owned this area and who owned this area? And the Hittites, they were at their greatest time. At their greatest, they had pushed the Amorites out, which the Babylonians represented here were the Amorites. The Amorites, remember I told you, some went to India, and we have traces of them in India, and then the rest of them came to Canaan. And so all that's left here of the Amorite kingdoms, they become the Amalekites that we see Joshua fight later. They're in Canaan, and this is all Hittites. And so the Hittites were probably one of the greatest kingdoms during that time. The Hittites are overthrown in 1200 BC, and we're not going to get there tonight, but 1200 BC, some significant things happen around the world that lead to that. The other empire that is beginning to rise is what's known, I've listed here, as the Mycenaeans and the Minoans. The Mycenaeans are over in this area, which is Greece, and the Minoans were on Crete. All we know going back, the earliest recorded time that we have of the Mycenaeans is 1580 BC, and that's what Homer tells us. And so we don't know. Homer makes it sound like they were already been an established country empire. Not really. They had city-states for 1,000 years in 1580, which it's hard to believe, maybe 500 years, because civilization in the early Iron Age wasn't that developed. But they had grown. The Minoans, on the other hand, had advanced. They were probably the most advanced kingdom and empire of all the empires because they were a seagoing people. The Minoans on Crete controlled all of the Mediterranean. And so they went everywhere and traded with everybody and took in the best knowledge and took in the best of everything. And so they grew and grew and grew. That is when we begin to see the Greek mythology that we have today. You begin to see that spring up. And the first time that we begin to see it spring up is the Mycenaeans, as they expand into Crete and begin to coexist with the Minoans. And the Mycenaeans grow and grow and grow to the point that they eventually kick the Minoans out of Crete. They expand over here and go to war against the Hittites and take over this part of Asia Minor. This is Turkey today. So they take over this part. And so that is what we call the early Mycenaean Empire in 1400 BC. So when they're in slavery, this is all going on in Greece and in Asia Minor. The Minoans, when the Minoans get kicked out, it's covered in Greek mythology. I listed it there. You remember the Greek myth about the Minotaur being defeated, the half man, half beast. The Minotaur comes representing the Minoan people. And it's Trajan that comes and destroys it and sends them off. We don't know what happens specifically to the Minoans. There is a group of people that appears for the next 800 years that are known as the Sea People. And they end up taking over this area, or part of this area, and they integrate with the Phoenicians. But they battle Egypt, they battle the Mycenaeans, they battle the Greek Empire when the Greek Empire is starting to get. And many people think the Minoans become this Sea People that we'll talk about a lot once we get into them going into Canaan, because these people encounter Joshua a whole lot because they integrate with the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians owned this land. They were the other rich kingdom beside Egypt, Hittites, Minoans, and Mycenaeans. They have about 200-mile strip of land that goes about 20 miles in, where Lebanon is today, if you can think of Lebanon. Starting up here, and they were on the coast all the way down, and that is the Phoenicians. Well, the Phoenicians, many people, historians believe, when the Minoans showed up, the Phoenicians and Minoans kind of intermarried, and they became a group of people that we call the Philistines. Because the Philistines were very trained in metallurgy that the Phoenicians hadn't experienced. And so I tell you all that. Mycenaeans become the Greek Empire. Put on there just to give you a time period. The Trojan War takes place in 1190. That is when the children of Israel are already in Canaan. They've been established in Canaan. But the reason the whole Trojan War took place is because this was all part of the Mycenaean Empire. And then the Hittites came back in, and which were forebears to the Persians, came back in and pushed them off. And that's when you began to see Persia and Greece fight for the land. This is the land barrier between Asia and Europe. And so it's very important land. And so you begin to see lots of wars take place in that. And that picks us up in Exodus, in the book of Exodus. And I just give me a few minutes and I'll cover some things, and we'll cover it more in depth. We don't know in that 400-year period how long they were slaves, as I said. All we know is the last 75 to 80 years was bad. They couldn't leave. They were working, but they weren't really punished until that last part. And Exodus tells us in Exodus 1:8 that there was a Pharaoh that rose up that did not know Joseph. Most people believe, historians believe, that is a Pharaoh named Amos I. He is Amos the first, and he is the leader of what's known as the Egyptian New Kingdom, or the 18th dynasty. He became king in 1570 to 1546. The reason we believe that is he purged Egypt of all foreigners. He put them in slavery. He shipped them out, wouldn't let people come in. He went to war in the northern part of, this is the northern part of Egypt because of the Nile River, went to war against the Phoenicians, went to war against the Canaanites, the people that were living in Canaan at the time. And so most people think that this is who it was. His daughter, he had a daughter named I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. It's listed there, but she became the first woman Pharaoh that we have traditionally documentation for. She became Pharaoh. And in between her dad and her, there were three cousins and brothers. It was a tumultuous time after Amos the first died. Most people, scholars believe that his daughter was the one who found Moses. You remember Moses is born in Exodus chapter 1. His parents are Levites from the tribe of Levi, which means he comes, older brother Aaron's a priest. He comes from the priestly line. Amos the first decides the Hebrews are having too many kids, and he says, I want you to kill all the firstborn, or really all the male children of the Hebrews. And so they kill all the males, and this Levite mother decides she doesn't want. She puts him in a basket, and Hatmashef finds him and raises him as their own. Also in Exodus 1, you see again, it's the very first time that we see a uniform term for the word Hebrew be used. The aparu that we saw before, which meant foreigner, all of a sudden Hebrew comes to describe specifically this group of people that were enslaved, that were known as the tribe of Israel or the people of Israel. And I listed on there that we have Egyptian tablets that use the word Hebrew dating back to 400 B.C. Moses is raised. We don't know a lot about Moses' childhood. Most of what we think we know about Moses' childhood, we get from movies or TV or whatever you want to say. We don't know a lot about Moses. He's probably raised in Pharaoh's court. He's the daughter of the Pharaoh, and he's the nephew of the next Pharaoh and the cousin of the next Pharaoh, and then he's the son of a Pharaoh because she becomes Pharaoh when he's about 30 years old. And so many people believe that Moses was in her court, but the Pharaohs that come after her, Thutmose, which are her nieces and nephews, they know Moses was not hers. She didn't give birth to Moses. And so they're fighting for who's going to be king and who's not. And so Moses kind of is falling out of favor with his cousins who want to be Pharaoh. And people guess that Moses' mother, his stepmother, the Pharaoh, she's killed by an assassin. They believe it was her nephew who became the Pharaoh that had her killed. And about that time, Moses kills Egyptian, and fearing that his cousin would use that against his mother, he flees to Midian. And so that's all we know. But he was raised royally. It wasn't an accident that Moses was picked, because Moses' first cousin is going to be Pharaoh that he goes back and visit. He is a son of the Pharaoh. Even though he's been gone 40 years, you know, you can't just go. The Egyptian Empire was the strongest empire in the world at this time. You can't just go knock on Pharaoh's door and go, hey, I'm here to speak for the children of Israel. I want to talk. You had to have reason to be allowed in. Moses had a reason to be allowed in because he was raised in Pharaoh's court. All the people that were there knew him even 40 years later. And so Moses goes for 40 years and goes over to Midian, which is this area. So you can see some of that. So he's raised in Midian. The interesting thing about Midian when he gets over there is he finds people that worship God, that worship the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And there's some interesting things there that maybe some of the Edomites, who you remember came from Ishmael, they began to worship the God of Abraham because they speak and they do some of the same things that we see while he's over there. And then God shows up in a burning bush, calls Moses back to come let his people go. Questions so far. The Pharaoh's during the interim time, he's there 40 years, he's married, kids. The Pharaoh's during the interim time between Moses' stepmother and the time Moses comes back are horrible. They persecute everybody. And it says the persecution got so bad that as the Egyptians called out, Exodus 2:25, God heard their cry, and that's when he went and got Moses and called him to come. And so Moses comes. We have the whole conversation, the burning bush. You have the conversation with who sent me. He gives him his name, I Am, which is significant. It's the first time that we actually hear God's name given, which is Yahweh. That's what that YWH, I'll talk more about it in a couple of weeks, but that YWH, the reason that is because in Hebrew, that's how you spell I Am, YWH. There's no vowels in Hebrew. And so we really don't even know how they pronounce it. We say Yahweh, because later on the Jewish scribes added sounding to make it sound like Adonai, because instead you couldn't say Yahweh. Regular Jewish people couldn't say Yahweh. You'd be killed for it. Yahweh, the word I Am in Hebrew basically means the one who caused into being, the one who created being. Now it's what we would interpret as Lord Almighty. Whenever you see Yahweh in the Old Testament, it's translated Lord Almighty. But then, to a Jewish person, it meant the one who created, the one who made. It means I Am. And the reason that I Am became Yahweh is because that's what it looked like in Hebrew. And they added, since you couldn't say Yahweh, they said Adonai. And Adonai meant Lord. And so anytime in the Old Testament you see Lord, that's Adonai. Later on, the Jewish people decided, well, how do we pronounce this YWH? They took the vowel points from Adonai and added it to YWH, and that made it sound like Jehovah. So that YWH became Jehovah. But that's not how they probably pronounced it. And so you wonder, where do we get Jehovah and Adonai and Yahweh? And why is it a big deal that he told him his name? He didn't tell Abraham his name. In that time period, it was an intimate for God, Creator, to be that self-aware to say, this is who I am. And so that's a big deal. No, that's exactly what it is. They've added, now it's YHWH to make it sound out. So, but the original I am is translated YWH. But what you see it now in ideographic speech is that they've added another H. So you'll have YHWH. And then they added to make the long vowel sound. That's how you, because in Hebrew it's dots. The vowels are just dots that they add on top, Semitic language on top of the, and that determines if it's long or short or if it's an I, E, U. And you couldn't get it to sound, you couldn't get the YWH to sound like Adonai unless you added an H to it. And then you could make that Yah, which goes to Jehovah. And so that's where the Yahovah. So it's English. So I'm going to end there. The Pharaoh, who was Pharaoh that Moses confronts? We don't know. The best guess is it is his cousin, his first cousin, Amenhotep II, during that time period, because of the time period of when it all happens. But I think, in my study, I think it's Amenhotep II. It's because he was cruel. He had a great start to his reign, and then something happened in the middle, and he just kind of falls off the earth. And biblical scholars would say that was because his firstborn son was killed, because he had fought. He'd been fighting for that 40 years to be Pharaoh because he was not legitimate. And so he'd been fighting Moses' stepmom and his uncles and his brothers to be Pharaoh. And so when his son died, that lost his heir, and it just kind of took the sails out of his kingdom. And so, and you know, historically we don't have any mention of those things, but we'll talk more about that stuff in a couple of weeks. Any questions? I'll let you.
About how many pharaohs you think there were between the time of Joseph to the time that Moses is leaving?
Most people think there were 8. There's a kingdom, the Hyksos. We don't have all the records of those pharaohs, so there could have been 15 or 20. Most people would estimate it's probably a 350-year period. Some of them, like his stepmom, only lived. She only reigned 8 years. So I mean, there's not. So and we'll talk next time about, you know, where's the Red Sea? How did they get there? Passover and the plagues, because I want you to see what the plagues are, because it's very important to see how that plays. So, any other questions?